Robert Stark. I am joined here with James O'Mara. We're going to be discussing his new book out, Green Nazis and Space. James, great having you back on the show.
It's great to be here again.
And I'm also joined here with a Rabbit and Alex von Goldstein. Great having you guys on,
hey,
too.
Thanks.
It's great to be on, and I think this is probably the first time that a writer for Countercurrents has been on a radio show with someone with the last name Goldstein, so it's a monumentous occasion.
It's funny because I posted a show the other day on Facebook, and someone was like, oh, is that one of those troll accounts that you see on Twitter and YouTube? Like, there's that like Shlomo von Schekelberg.
Yeah, Alex von Goldstein is basically, like, I am the real version of von Schekelberg.
Yeah, and I noticed that when you posted that, you know, that Pepe episode with Goldstein on the 8chan Facebook, the very first comment or something was the guy said Goldstein.
Yeah, they had to name the Jew immediately. It's okay.
Well, you know what happens is that Facebook keeps, in its Skynet sort of way, keeps recommending people to your friends and so on. And one of my more normal friends said to me one day, "Say, who is this von Schekelstein character? He seems to be one of your friends, and Facebook keeps telling me that we should be friends." I said, "Oh, well, you know, it's all Facebook, it's all crazy, you know, and all kinds of weird people and so on." Yeah. Must be a friend of a friend. I've never heard of such a thing.
Was that me?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, James, your book, Green Nazis in Space, you have everything from Nazis to homoeroticism. So it's sort of a book to offend just about everyone.
It's an extremely offensive book, and I think the best part of it is just the idea that the occasional person who's going to be searching Amazon to find out about the relations between the Nazis and the Green Movement will get my book at a selection. Which was completely unintentional, of course, because the Green Nazis in this case are Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah, they're going to be like looking. They're going to be looking for like Hitler's anti-smoking policy books on things like that.
Exactly.
To find your book.
Yes.
Well, James, you have this unique ability to take just anything from popular culture, from comic books to Hollywood films, to even some of the most lowbrow stuff, and find some kind of cultural insight to it.
I try. There's a sort of theme that runs through that book and runs through most of my writings that's been put into art, and that is that. Starting from the notion of the irreducible Jewish component in what passes for Western or conservative or thought, and moving on from that to who's behind that.
Well, your book is very different from your sort of standard alt-right fare, which says that basically that our culture was great until basically the homos took over Hollywood and ruined everything.
Well, that's true. I have to say that someone on Amazon posted a review a few days ago saying that my earlier book, The Eldritch Evola, was the greatest alt-right book they had ever read. I can only assume that that's true. That's the greatest book that they've read. And I humbly accept that that notion. There's a recurring theme that a lot of what passes for conservatism, conservative thought, is basically just people nostalgic for their childhood. And they think that the rot set in at some particular point in their teenage years or early adulthood. And if we could only turn the clock back to, 1982 or 1965 or something like that, everything would be fine. And I'd try to demonstrate that the rot is somewhat deeper than that. In particular, in the second essay in that book called Welcome to the Club, I take a look at the way Hollywood has changed our notions of masculinity and adolescence, and point out the curious fact that prior to one of the later movies in the Andy Hardy series, just before the Second World War, in literature and in the movies, boys were real boys. Manly boys were considered to have no interest in women at all, and were expected to form gangs of their own and hang out amongst themselves and so on. And there's a very particular point that you can locate in Hollywood history where they decided they would change this and introduce what they called girl craziness. And, what's interesting is that the standard conservative thinks of normal boys as essentially being what the Jews running the Hollywood studios in the late 1930s decided would be the model, namely girl crazy. The notion that at a certain age, boys just become girls, as normal boys, of course. Of course, they have to be normal, otherwise they'll be fags, so we can't have that. And so this whole really rather Negroid notion of boys being obsessed with girls and obsessed with pregnancy and getting girls knocked up and so on, this idea was actually manufactured by the Hollywood studios in the late 30s. And it's partly related to the Judaic takeover of Hollywood and the culture, and in particular the run-up of the Second World War to create a fighting race of people to send off to Europe. I think that's probably possibly the most interesting, possibly the most important essay in the book. Really a key to a lot of other things that I've been writing.
And you review this book. It's called We Boys Together, Teenagers in Love Before Girl Craziness by Jeffrey Dess. I haven't read the book, but I know I was reading over the reviews on Amazon, and he got some kind of nasty comments saying that he's some old perv who's into, like, young boys, and that he wants to imply that, like, boys were homosexual in Hollywood, and it just, like, some of the comments were really pretty out there.
Yeah, I mean, you always get that on Amazon. Let me put it this way. It's not him. It's Louis B. Mayer, the mogul behind MGM. The guy in Mommy Dearest that tells Joan Crawford she's box office poison. It's Louis B. Mayer who said, and I quote, "We have to be careful. If we make Andy Hardy too interested in girls, we'll lose our audience." So that's his quote, not the guy writing the book. You can read it for yourself. And he documents these things. I mean, if you look at the standard Hollywood melodramas of the 20s and 30s, up in the mid 40s, let's say, there's basically the notion of boys. Manly boys, real boys, being off by themselves and forming their own little groups and so on, which of course is related to the Aryan Manor Bund.
you know, finding a mentor who will guide them into manhood and all that.
Boys who are interested in girls were portrayed as sissies, as effeminate, and so on. You know, oh, they're interested in girls. Well, they must be girls, you know, which is, of course, the exact inversion of today's notion, that boys are supposed to be obsessed with girls. Well, you know, I mean, this idea that boys are supposed to be obsessed with sex is the sort of thing, the sort of poison that the Jewish mentality introduces. And it's all part of the Negroization of our culture to make boys uninterested in the church, Boy Scouts, school, all these other faggot activities, and exclusively set their minds on scoring with girls.
One of the theories in your chapter is that there is a notion in culture that male bonding is sort of synonymous with homosexuality.
Yeah. The you know, what you find is you know, when the early psychological scientists in the late 19th century decided there was something called a homosexual. You know, this was a new category, and by the 1930s, thanks to Freud and the other Jewish psychoanalysts, this became a sort of a terrifying category that boys might fall into if they weren't properly guided. And the proper guidance, of course, was to steer them towards girl craziness. And this is the origin of the general suspicion of any kind of male activities. So by today, of course, you know, I mean, this was the era when scoutmasters and priests and so on were the heroes and of films, like Mr. Scoutmaster with Clifton Webb, Bing Crosby and Going My Way, and so on. Today, of course, it's just assumed that any scoutmaster or priest in a movie is going to be a child molester. Public schools, of course, oh, that's nothing but a bunch of spanking and sodomy and so on. All the institutions of Aryan society get tarred with this idea that, well, if they're not chasing after girls, they must be a bunch of fags. Of course, as I, you know, explored in earlier work, this is part of the general notion that anything associated with culture, anything associated with white race and so on is faggotry. That if you want to be a real man, you have to be as much like a Negro as possible. This is something that's inculcated by the Jew, and carried on by the typical conservative who buys into this whole picture. But I try to show that if you're going to be a conservative and you think the old days were best, well, let's take a look at the old days. And the old days were not really like modern conservatives think of the old. And you know, boys were not obsessed with girls. Old days, and that didn't mean that they were fags. It meant they were real men. I talk about the movies, of course, because that's most girls easily accessible. You can get them on Netflix and so on. If you look at the books, children's books and young adult novels of right up into the 30s and so on, that's generally the picture. And that's why when you read those things or you see those movies, there's always like this sniggering camp sort of sense of like, oh, we know what they're really doing. Any movie from the 30s that's set in a boys' school, oh, we know what they're really talking about. You know, this whole notion that continues on to the standard left-wing critique of movies like 300 or Fight Club and so on. Well, they're all just fags.
This whole like the kind of white masculine man being a fag. When does this really start? Because I feel like, you know, I was born in 1989, and, you know, growing up and just seeing, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, those guys were still sort of seen as, like, the macho man. And in a movie like Predator or something, you just have, you know, the macho men running through the jungle, and there isn't really this emotional relationship between Schwarzenegger and Maria Conchita Alonso and stuff like that. So, you know, have there been waves of this throughout the last 50 years or so, or is it, or do you see it sort of just a downward spiral?
Yeah, I think it's a downward spiral. I think, you're right. I mean, you're right to point out. I mean, there probably are waves. I mean, nothing works like that. I mean, René Guénon, who you might think of as being, you know, the great metaphysical spokesman for the idea of, you know, metaphysical decline, is very explicit about that. That you know, there are cycles. You know, there are waves up and down. So yeah, you know. You're absolutely right, now that I think of it, that and during that period, from, like, say, Rocky through maybe Rambo 2, there was a wave of Hollywood films that were sort of like, you know, macho, as it were. But, of course, if you mention any of those films today, you know, the standard cultural commentator, you know, the standard leftist cultural commentator is going to snigger about homoeroticism.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I mean, obviously they were enormously popular. You know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, the original Hollywood productions were popular, and they were intended to be popular, and then there was a sort of like creeping ideological change. But you always get these like atavistic resurgences. You know, someone like John Milius, for instance, and
sure, yeah,
great things he's done. But he's obviously, you know, an outlier in Hollywood. And, you know, is always being, you know, you just Google his name and you'll no doubt find some kind of scandal or some horrible accusation about him. You know, he got drunk and tried to shoot some people. You know, that's why we need gun control. You know, there's always something about Milius or and Schwarzenegger, obviously, and so on. You know, but you know, so yeah, I mean, you know, that whole 80s period. This is a slightly different topic, but that whole 80s period. You know, when Reagan was in office and all that, is sort of like frozen as this kind of object of horror among leftists and so on. I mean, so, oh, the 80s, you know, anything to do with the 80s, you know, oh, well, women had shoulder pads, you know, like, what, you know, how is that any different than any other kind of fashion? I mean, there's, you know, this fashion, you know, but it's something unique. Nobody ever says, oh, those awful clothes they wore in the 20s. You know, those very 1930s hairdos. You know, that awful music. You know, like one of my favorite movies, what I think is one of the greatest movies ever made, is Manhunter.
Oh yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, there's always, and you can Google this or look on Amazon or whatever. You know, I mean, there's always like a hardcore of like maybe 30% of people who say it's so 80s. You know, the music is from the 80s. The clothes are from the 80s. Well, for fuck's sake, was made in the 80s. Like,
yeah,
what
there
kind
is
of
like
music
this,
should it have
yeah.
had? Ragtime or Delta blues or something that's authentic and rooty like that?
There
is
an
attempt.
Yeah.
In the 80s. It's an 80s movie. You know, but that by itself, you know, no one would say, oh, it's a Public Enemy? That's so 30s. You know, Apocalypse
yeah,
Now?
Like,
oh, my God. You know, that 1979 all over again.
Yeah,
the
it's
music
like 70s
is
are 60s. Cool.
Yeah,
yeah
60s
yeah,
no
and 70s
one, yeah,
are
exactly,
cool.
No one,
80s
yeah,
are
no
bad.
One would ever say, oh, my God, it starts off with the Doors. I mean, that's so 60s. You know? I mean, God.
Maybe they would. Maybe they
have you
would
seen Jim Morrison's hair? Oh,
yeah.
His clothes are so awful. You know, I mean, come on, nobody does that except for the 80s, and I think that's because, as you bring up, you know, there was that like, under Reagan...
Resurgence of masculinity.
This resurgence of masculinity. I mean, the idea of Rambo, you know, single-handedly fighting the Russians, it's so comical, it's so camp, man. We appreciate it now because it's so camp.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but it's the same way. I mean, stuff that was perfectly straightforward in... This is why I like Mystery Science Theater, you see, because a lot of times, particularly with short educational films, where they're explicitly trying to educate people in how to eat dinner and how to dress and so on, there's a real nerve that's struck about, you know, the idea that, you know, being concerned about your personal appearance, oh, that's Eisenhower's conformity, or et cetera, you know. I mean, there's like in the...
in the culture, there's like this sort of just a nerve that's hit about anything along those lines. And one aspect of that is the idea that two men together without a woman, they must be fags. You know, I mean, it could never be anything else.
Well, I was thinking about Deliverance too, because that, I mean, I love that movie, and I love any kind of movie where you have like men thrown into the wilderness, sort of forced to become men again. But then when I'm thinking about it, I'm like, you know, what does everyone think about? Like, when I think about Deliverance, I think about, you know, the office guy being forced to sort of discover the group of men as like a survival tactic. But then when everyone else thinks about Deliverance, they just think about a dude porking another guy in the ass.
Well, you know, I can't, unfortunately, I can't recall the context or what it was said about it. But, I mean, I did read something online recently where somebody was grousing about that this was, James Dickey, in writing this, that this was some, some liberal, urban northerner sort of person with some kind of fantasy of what people are doing out in the backwoods, that's true. I think there's that whole trope of don't drive off road because you'll find all these horrible white people. And they'll all be inbred and toothless and they'll bugger you and all that. You know, I mean, it's just, this is like, this like becomes automatically assumed. I wrote a piece that hasn't been collected in hardcover. It's for a future book on movies a while back on Countercurrents about Rob Zombie's film. And the fun he has with that general sort of notion, which I guess goes back to, you can trace it. It's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but before then you had like 10,000 Maniacs, films like that. The general notion that if you go off the road, which is also kind of interesting because it was during a period when people drove, when they took vacation, and they would
driving vacations.
Yeah, they'd pile. Yeah, that's what a vacation meant. If you were rich, for part of the jet set. But normal people, normal working class people who got 2 weeks off a year, or who had Labor Day weekend off, would jump in the car. And the last movie that sort of like memorializes that, of course, is National Lampoon's Vacation. Which is very surrealistic to look at today, or even from a few years ago, it was odd to look at because the whole idea of like, why are they in a car? Like, what's wrong with these people? the whole thing almost makes no sense in contemporary terms. But people used to, from like the 20s to the 80s and so on, people would drive all across America. And even before there was a national highway system, they'd drive on those awful old roads. And, like the postman always rings twice or something like that. There'd be like a little roadside restaurant and there might be danger there.
And I noticed people have kind of lost their sense of exploration. If they want to go to a destination, like, I want to go to New York, I want to get there as quick as possible. But
they want to schedule the whole thing out, too.
Part of going to a place is exploring the places that on the way and kind of exploring the unexpected, but people have just sort of lost their sense of adventure. And I think a lot of that has to do with the kind of culture of kind of instant gratification. People want things as fast as possible.
Exactly.
You can never be bored. You can't be bored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even in
there's that whole trope of the children whining in the back of the car. which presumably never happens anymore because you just give them games or something. They have their Game Boy or something. People used to travel all around the country and they would see this stuff. The Annie of Mayberry show was started as an episode of Danny Thomas program, and in the episode Danny Thomas is driving through North Carolina. Now, I mean, why would some rich New York TV star be driving through North Carolina? Because people did that. And guess what, he gets caught in a speed trap and he meets Andy Griffith. and they have their little thing, and it was so popular that they turned it into a television series, which became so popular. That would be impossible today, you know. Which gets us to our other topic, or one of your other suggested topics, namely the idea of these white utopias.
Because what we
don't have anymore, we don't have these Mayberries that people might drive through, real towns with real white working class people. We have these sort of like pseudo environments like Boulder, Colorado, or Stars Hollow on the Gilmore Girls that I've written about.
I think it was Steve Saylor wrote an article about Boulder, and it was in response to an article saying, like, this is like the America we should strive for, and it's totally against what Trump wants. And then Steve Saylor pointed out the demographics of Boulder. And those type of towns, they're great places to live if you can afford them, but
yeah.
most white people can't afford those places. You can make sort of a point that a lot of those people are hypocrites, but those are generally kind of the kind of places that have like the highest standard of living and highest quality of life, but if you can afford them.
Well, you see, it's not only ordinary white people can't afford them, more importantly, in a sense, although maybe not to these people, because they hate white people too. They hate lower class white people, working class white people. But of course, they don't so much hate, because they'd never admit that, but they don't want to be around blacks and Hispanics. So by upping the price of stuff, upping the price of the real estate, they drive out the working class whites who created the community, and they keep out the blacks and Hispanics. You know, the blacks who emigrate within America and the Hispanics who come flooding in from the South. It's the other, you know, the working class whites have to live in their own little areas, and they have to battle the blacks and the Hispanics. And these white folks who have jobs and money and so on can create these little communities. And the point I made in the article about the Gilmore Girls, which is in my first book, is that white people love... See, the alt-right is correct that these kinds of small towns are ideal communities, and they're racially homogeneous. But so white liberals love to live in these communities, but first they have to purge them of all those horrible other white people. And they have to keep the blacks and Hispanics out. They can't do that with racial segregation and so on, so they do both things by raising the price of real estate. So you have these communities like Martha's Vineyard or the Hamptons. This happens quite naturally in college towns, where you get the rich kids from outside the community who come in to go to school. So you have places like Ann Arbor and Madison, Burlington, Berkeley, etc. And these are all these little hypocritical white utopias where they sit back and say, well, look how wonderful it is. We're all so smart and we're educated, and we have no crime and no guns. And everyone's welcome as long as they can afford the real estate.
In your article about Gilmore Girls and Occupy Wall Street, you critique James Kunstler, who's written a lot of books and articles kind of promoting these small towns in places like Boulder and Vermont. And mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying, but Kunstler does have a point, because a lot of kind of white conservative communities, they have this extreme free market ideology. There's the sort of poorer white communities, even like upper middle class white suburban communities, a lot of them end up getting ruined. The wealthier ones have like the McMansions, and the working class ones end up like they have like Walmart coming in and destroying a lot of the small towns. So I think Kunstler does make a lot of valid points.
Oh yeah, he makes a lot of valid points. I mean, he's a fascinating figure to me. Sort of like a classic gatekeeper. Now, his job is to diagnose the problem, which he does very accurately and very eloquently, and prescribe the solution, which he does very, very eloquently. But he always manages to like divert the discussion from a certain point. I've actually been banned from commenting on his site, and I got an email from him to that effect, because I had pointed out that he had written something about the decline of American culture from 1945 to today and so on. And I pointed out that this decline coincided with the ascent of a certain tribe to which he belonged. And as a result, I got an email from some scatological language and banning me from his site. So his job is to diagnose the problem and sketch out the solution, but never allow anyone to actually, do anything constructive about it. You know, I mean, he despises the white working class just like the rest of his tribe. So there's no help to be found there. You know, he's not going to organize the white working class. He wants them to die. Wants them to go away. They're just a bunch of tattooed rednecks. And he described them once as the white pus that infects our nations. And so he wants them all to die. And his goal, if you took him seriously, is live like he lives in Capital District in upstate New York, sort of like a decayed old time industrial city that's been somewhat revived. Some unspecified way. I mean, his bigger picture is, peak oil and all this other stuff is going to bring about a return to 1905, I think, is year. And he points out correctly that 1905 was not a horrible year.
I've heard James Kunstler criticize immigration before, and he's written about some of these like anti-immigration politicians in Europe, and he didn't flat out endorse them, but he said like they had like legitimate grievances. So I have a more nuanced view on James Kunstler, but I get what you're saying.
Well, yeah, I have seen him. Actually, I haven't seen him speak well of European immigration people. That would be consistent with what I'm saying, though, because it's those sophisticated Europeans are probably able to make these points without exciting the rabble. But as soon as it comes to America, he's definitely he's anti-Clinton. He denounces her in all the right ways.
Well,
he's also anti-Trump, so his position is all
that. But he doesn't say that Trump is like a racist for opposing mass immigration. He's more that like he just likes Trump because Trump is like crude and crass and is not a coherent intellectual. That's mainly his reason for opposing Trump.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you're right. But I think the sense that I get is I've written this on Facebook. For what that matters, about a couple of his things that he seems to be sort of like finding his way to positioning himself in such a way as that when if Trump wins, he can say, you see, I said it wouldn't be so bad or something. I have seen him in the last 6 months or so speak more kindly of Trump. That's certainly true.
I just wanted to revisit what we were talking about before, the vacations, even in National Lampoon's Vacation. Remember at the beginning, his whole family is like, Dad, why aren't we flying, Clark? And it's because even then it was kind of like it was seen as an old-fashioned thing, a family trip or whatever.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, actually, in the early 80s, we drove across country to Phoenix. I think I talked about this before with Robert on another episode, whereas we all across the country we stopped at like every kind of weird gift shop and hokey like tourist spot cafe on the way, stopped at like Petrified Forest and Meteor Crater and all the stuff that I guess people go to those things now just so they can take Instagram selfies or something and post them. But the idea of a family vacation, same thing he mentioned Labor Day, we used to always go camping on Labor Day. And people, I guess people still do those kind of things, but it's more for like an aesthetic or something than for the actual experience.
Yeah.
It's certainly not a family thing.
Well, I think people do things so that they can record them and essentially send them out online. Like, people view themselves almost like micro-celebrities within their communities.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. About the vacation, about the Lampoon vacation, yeah, you're right. That is a more subtle point about it, that the family is already wondering why we're not flying, and Griswold has these sort of like atavistic nostalgia for the idea of traveling across country like that. I guess in the Christmas movie, you have the same thing where he's trying to recreate some kind of 1950s Christmas, and even though it's the late 80s. So you can actually see the difference in the generation in that. Yeah, it used to be an integral part of people's lives, and now it's more like an ironic thing to post on Facebook. Yeah.
Oh, and I was just going to say about the films, it's when people talk about the 80s, and you do hear it a lot with the 70s too, especially like sci-fi, like, oh my God, look how those people were dressed or whatever. But I think that it always kind of bugs me, because I think that the 1970s future aesthetics, and even the 80s to some degree, is such a superior look to what we have now. Like, I think most of this stuff that we have is just garbage, you know? So
yeah.
It's like, when people make fun of these the way women looked in the 70s or something, like, I think it's like, well, it's completely superior to what you see now. And the same goes for a lot of these movies that come out. Like, I have a lot of, I really appreciate, Countercurrents and these other outlets that take the time to review all of these modern movies, because, like, and analyze them, because I think most of them are just like, these movies are just garbage, you know? So it's like, I feel like, you know, you guys sit through like Zootopia and that shit so that I don't have to, you know?
Well, just to go on the future movies thing, I feel like in the 70s and, you know, definitely in the 60s and definitely in the 50s and before that, the future was seen as this thing to come, whereas I think now we've sort of gone into this phase where we think the future is going to be negative. Like, a movie of Children of Men is what most people see as the future, I feel.
Interesting.
One other factor about how people kind of make fun of the 80s is the 80s were also seen as being super white, and sort of the 90s was the predominance of like a hip-hop culture.
Exactly. It was maybe like the 70s too. I mean, glad you brought up the 70s future. I mean, the 70s, those movies are like projecting a white future from the 70s onward. You know, if the 70s continued, this is what the future would look like. Well, it didn't turn out like that. Well, I wonder why.
I mean, even in Children of Men, there's all these jihadis in the street blowing up people throughout London. So it's, yeah.
I remember seeing somebody writing a comment online. Like, there was an article about these old movies and how they, how they got the future wrong or whatever. And there was one of the examples was Soylent Green and the overpopulation. And one of the comments was really funny. Someone commented on it and said, like, you know, one thing Soylent Green definitely got wrong is that that they thought there was going to be that many white people in the future.
Soylent Green is white people.
So, James, you have this chapter in your book, Reflections on Sartorical Fascism, and it's about basically fashion sense. You cover a lot of topics from, like, the decline of military uniforms to, like, men's swimwear. You also talk about, like, basketball shorts, how men wore, like, short basketball shorts in the 70s.
You know,
and then Michael Jordan kind of popularized, like, the long, like, knee-length basketball shorts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Anne Sturzenegger in her review of Green Nazis said that, talked about the almost depressive level of interconnection among everything that I write. It seemed as if I was writing three or four different articles at the same time. So everything really ties in together. Now, you mentioned
shorts. And I think in that article, if not somewhere else, I take James Kunstler to task for his puzzlement. I forget exactly what the context was, but he was puzzled about why basketball players wore baggy shorts. Yes, see, this is an example of what I'm talking about. Kunstler wrote a little piece to show how stupid white Americans are. And his illustration was that he went to Dick's Sporting Goods in Schenectady, where he lives up. And, you know, the mall was deserted and everything's dirty and everyone has tattoos and piercings and so on. The usual Kunstler line. And he couldn't find any swimwear because there were all these baggy sort of swim trunks, right? And the guy behind the counter was some stupid guy with tattoos and piercings, and he couldn't explain things and so on. And doesn't this show how messed up our culture is? Well, he doesn't have a clue, right? Now, I give the real story there, which is that this is part of the Negrofication of culture, right? Which he'd rather chop off his right hand than say anything. But as you say, as I document, you know, I mean, it used to be the case that you know, white people were proud of their bodies and showed them off. You know, I've written in a previous book about "Kiss Me Deadly," starring Ralph Meeker, and I note in Green Nazis in that article that there's a whole internet culture about Ralph Meeker in a Speedo. Because in an episode of The Outer Limits called Tourist Attraction, where there's a South American republic that finds a prehistoric fish and tries to make it a tourist attraction, and it turns on and all that. It's a stupid Outer Limits episode. But they're horrified by the fact that Ralph Meeker is in it, and he's on a boat, and he's wearing a Speedo. And everybody's talking about how horrible it is, and oh my God, you can see his stuff and all that. And so on. This is normal white people attire in 1962.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because the resurgence of some of that kind of clothing was brought about by American Apparel, which, you know, was owned by Dove Charney, you know, who was famously Jewish, and while bringing that back, he also increased that association as that, you know, as far as that kind of clothing on guys being associated with homosexuals and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah,
if you think about it.
Yeah, that's sort of like recuperating it in sort of based in an exploitative way. This is, as I say, it's just like normal function. And, you know, and as you can see, when Kunstler's not talking about getting a Speedo. God, Kunstler and a Speedo. But he's not talking about that. He's talking about getting a normal, what seems to him and me and people of my generation to be a normal piece of swimwear, right? But he can't find it because everything has to be long and baggy, because anything else would be baggy. He can't get a normal. Think of Jim Kunstler. He's not looking for a Speedo to show himself off. He's looking for normal white people clothing, and he can't find it because you have to wear Michael Jordan baggy shorts because, A, everyone wants to look like Michael Jordan, apparently, and, two, anything else would make you a fag. I mean, that's our culture. He's right. I mean, that is our culture, but he thinks it's just they're too stupid to size things correctly. He actually says that. They're too stupid to size things correctly.
I remember a while back, Steve Saylor wrote an article, and he talked about when he was in school, like, everyone would shower after gym class, and how today that's considered a very taboo. It's either equated with homosexuality or some, like, gym coach, like, checking out things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because either you're gay because you're taking a shower, because only homosexuals shower, or it's something set up so that the gym coach can fondle you or something like that. You know, again, this is not to make it sound overly homosexual, but you know, I mean, consider, for instance, guns. You know, at one time, not only were guns taught in New York public schools, but students brought their rifles to and from school on the subway. Right? Now, if somebody proposed that today, they'd be thought of as being a lunatic. But, you know, A, that you would teach children about how to handle rifles, and B, that you would have them carrying them on the subway. But that was normal behavior in white America.
Do you think part of it is that people felt safe in a more like homogenous environment?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a certain, you really don't need a rifle in New York for any normal purpose. But, there was probably a holdover of the idea of, from hunting, that people should know how to hunt. And they should also know how to defend themselves. See, again, this is something that's only considered, like, absurd in camp today, but the idea of civil defense. Well, they must have been crazy in the 50s. They were talking about civil defense, and those 80s movies like Red Dawn are camp, just like, Schwarzenegger and so on, right? And Milio's wrote that, right, didn't he, Red Dawn?
He wrote and directed Red Dawn.
Yeah, exactly. See, so, yep. I mean, that's just absurd today.
That movie essentially ruined his career, too. After Red Dawn, Milius basically went to a made-for-TV guy, so...
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's a visceral feeling that I get when I watch Red Dawn of, that I don't get when I watch other things. And, the conspiratorial part of my mind says that, the powers that be saw Red Dawn and they were like, okay, we can't let these people get too much of this feeling in them, because this idea, that, the government is our friend or like the state is our friend, because Thomas Jefferson said that the tree of liberty must be refilled with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
Yeah.
And if you say that, people just think you're absolutely insane. So,
right, yeah. Well,
that movie makes me feel bad, I should say.
That's just the sort of thing some old white racist slave owner, Ben Franklin.
Exactly. Yeah.
James, you also wrote a chapter on Michel Houellebecq, his sexual utopia, anti-sexual utopia, and Houellebecq he's not explicitly ideological or traditionalist, but he kind of writes in a sort of nihilistic sense, kind of chronicalizing the decline of civilization. James, remember last time we talked, we did talk about one of his books. Did you get a chance to read all his books?
No. I must confess. I haven't had a chance to read other than... That was a review of Elementary Articles.
Oh, yeah. And then I think his other famous book is the one, is it Whatever?
Whatever. Well, of course, more recently, the book Submission, which I also haven't read, but I've read the reviews on Countercurrents, it's very interesting because one thing that I take away from it, just having read the reviews and so on, or some understanding of the plot and so on, is talking about traditionalism and so on. I mean, there's a sense on the right, certainly among conservatives and neocons, to a certain extent on the alt-right as well, that Islam is some kind of monolithic force of evil or something like that, I think Houellebecq gives a good presentation of sort of historical situation in which an intelligent person looking for career advancement and so on would look at Islam and say, "Yeah, it's not so bad," and join up. He shows the appeal of Islam, not so much the idea of some twisted little guy who thinks, women should be clothed, I'm going to become a Muslim, that sort of nonsense, like this guy in Orlando, the idea of someone saying, this is a pretty reasonable, respectable religion, I can see how it could organize society better than we've been doing with our liberal democracy, and I'm going to join up and give it a shot. Not everyone who converts to Islam, certainly historically speaking, all through the last 1,300 years, has been, some sort of fanatical lunatic.
Didn't René Guénon convert to, I think, well, Sufism, to be specific?
Yeah, well, for one, let me say, use that as an opportunity to drop in this thing. I saw someone saying online somewhere that the reason people have such a twisted image of Islam is because it's where the oil was found.
And unfortunately, the oil was not found in cosmopolitan Parisian Beirut. And it wasn't found in scholarly, archaic Cairo. And that, of course, made me think of Gihon. It was found in the desert among the backward Wahhabi Bedouin scum.
So historically, the point you're making is the sort of cultural centers of the Muslim world, places like Iran, Syria, Lebanon, were historically where culture was centered. But then these really just these savages like screwing camels out in the desert just stumbled upon oil and then
set up. I mean, in fact, if you think about it, it's exactly like the United States. You know, if I can put on my cultural elitist hat, you know, where did they find the oil? In New York? Beverly Hills? No, they found it in some godforsaken desert out in Texas and Oklahoma in the swamps of Louisiana. You know? So the same thing with the Arab world. You know, you can't look at some backwoods Louisiana guy and say, yep, there's a typical Christian. Right there. You know? Our image of the Muslim is, these Saudi Arabian sheiks, swanning around, and they're not that way themselves, of course. But what they do is they have to buy off, the camel fuckers, right? And their money to buy them off, and that's how they're supporting, Wahhabism and so on. They don't live like Wahhabi ascetics, but they finance all these people. And they're the ones who are trying to impose that on Europe and the rest of the world. You know, it's because they have the money. You know, if they didn't have the money, then none of this would be an issue. And people would still be like everyone prior to 1950 or so and thinking of Islam as this interesting foreign religion where you have many wives. And everyone's cool on homosexuality and so on, et cetera, et cetera. And then these lunatics show up.
About Welbeck's theory, where he says that the sexual revolution he ties it in with free market economics?
I haven't thought about that very much, to be frank. I mean, there's something to that, certainly. You know, I mean, if you think of the sexual revolution as part of the whole modernization process, that's what it really amounts to. I mean, this is why we see the left, or so-called progressive elements of the left, essentially promoting globalism. You know, they're all on the side of Soros, which doesn't seem to make any sense. And you know, old Brooklyn socialists like Bernie Sanders will point that out. This doesn't make any sense. What they're doing is it really is in line with the left's project, which is destroy. All traditions, all nationalities, and so on, and they think it will create a kumbaya unity and so on, and the globalists think it will create a society of atomized consumers, and so they're all on the same page.
You see this a lot with young like Marxist types in the U.S. Like a friend of mine was giving me a lot of shit for associating with the people I do. and he said to me, about Russia and all this, he's like, you wouldn't believe the anti-gay stuff that Putin is passing over there, and sort of almost, sounding like a hawk, like a neocon hawk, but coming from like this progressive angle.
Yeah.
And it's like, I could see these social justice types supporting World War III with Putin to stop his, supposed homophobia.
Well, yeah, we've already seen this. We've seen Obama, going on some, The Daily Show or something, this was a couple of years ago, and talking about how terrible it was that Moscow was banning some kind of gay parade or something. And so on. Like, really? Really? That's the issue? That's the fight you're going to pick with Russia? That's the issue? That's why you're going to go to DEFCON 3 and launch the nuke? All that is because they banned a gay parade? I mean, how pitiful must that look to the rest of the world on the world stage?
No one cares about what's happening in the Ukraine. They care about, the parade. Yeah,
yeah exactly.
Interesting, though, is that because they're perfectly willing to take on Russia because Russia's white, but they won't say anything about the you know, the Middle East or the Muslims oppression, and you know, it's just that they're willing to call out Russia, especially as if we're becoming friendly with them or something like that. You know, what happened to allowing all of these nations self-determination and not intervening in their affairs? Then suddenly they want to interfere in you know, in Russia's affairs. And I think one thing I think is kind of weird is that the Russia's developed this kind of like neo-traditionalist kind of reputation, whereas a lot of conservatives are kind of fetishizing it, but they don't seem to realize that, like, a lot, like, all of the most, like, depraved pornography comes from Russia. Like, if you really want to see, like, the most violent, you know, fucked up pornography, that stuff is, it's all Russian, you know. The, so it's on the one hand, they've developed this kind of surface level traditionalism, but, you know, underneath you still have the real hard-ass kind of depraved Russian stuff underneath it all.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, you obviously know more about this than I. I'll have to investigate it.
Yeah, I haven't seen that either, Abbott. I'm a Puritan.
Can you send me a few links there, and then we'll go from...
James, this also kind of ties in with what we were talking about earlier with Kunstler, but you read an article called This Old Gay House, and you review this book called A Passion to Preserve Gay Men as Keepers of Culture, and the book is about how gay men have been at the forefront of things like historic preservation and upholding culture.
Is that what Milo does?
I think Milo is just copying a James O'Meara shtick.
That's right. he's obviously more palatable than I. So he's the successful public speaker engagement sort of version. You know, it's sort of like the Rolling Stones, and then you'd interview them and they'd say, "Yeah, man, but you should really listen to Blind Willie Jefferson, man. He's got the real stuff, you know."
You're the Blind Willie Jefferson.
I'm the blind Willie Jefferson of the alt right. But that's an interesting important point. And I hadn't thought of Kunstler in relation to that, but you're right. Yeah, that's tying in on that. But there's the tired meme on the right that gay people have no role in society and certainly no role in the future white rightist society because they have no children and they have no stake in the future, and therefore, you know, they're like Keynes, you know, saying in the long run we're all dead, so let's print all the money we want, you know, that sort of stuff. And this book, along the way, he's not a traditionalist and he's not even much of a philosopher. It's really just a bunch of interviews. But every now and then he waxes philosophical and he points out that gay men have a number of interests which involve, you know, what's called, what we would call on the right, on the alt-right, would call hauntology. They're interested in the past. They're interested in the roots of things. They're interested in preserving the past so that, as Heidegger would say, we go forward, because we can only go forward from the past. They're interested in cultural preservation, and that's their contribution to the future. If you have to look at it that way, I mean, what do they contribute to society? They contribute the past to society. And, you know, your typical conservative, your typical free market capitalist conservative is, you know, tearing everything down and putting up high-rises and so on and making money. And they're the ones saying, you know, we should preserve some of this stuff. You know, the past is important. You know, we like this stuff. And this gets into Kunstler, too, you know. I mean, we like living in the small town. We like living in the quaint old buildings. It makes us happy. And they should be preserved, and they serve a kind of, and he actually uses this phrase occasionally, a kind of shamanistic role, which gets to things I've written about since my first book, you know, the relation between not so much homosexuals, but as, shall we say, non-family value people, what role they play. Well, you know, it's not all about reproduction. That's not the be-all and end-all of society. We have something called culture. We have something called civilization, society, and so on. And gay men contribute to that and have always done so. And this is just yet another area. And it's interesting that he ties it into shamanism and religion and so on. You know, his point, as he says, is that in the modern world where everything is being destroyed by globalism and modern capitalism and so on, people who preserve the past are performing a religious function. And that's important. Point that out.